There is an otter in my water. Hi everyone, welcome to Crossfader's first ever podcast. This time we are going to be discussing Life is Strange, the video game by Donknod, and the final episode in particular, especially how it differs from the previous four and everything that's led up to it. With me I have today Ed Dutcher.
Hey, how's it going?
And Alec Larios.
Hello, hello.
So two game veterans right here, as well as myself, Sergio Zacho, I will be moderating. So let's start a little bit about Life is Strange, what it's about, episodes 1 through 4. Obviously there's going to be a lot of spoilers here, but we're going to try and tone it down because we're going to assume that the listeners have already played the game. So Ed, do you want to run us through this?
Oh, well, yes, of course. Episodes 1 through 4 were superb. This is, you know, largely in part because episodes 1 through 4 did a lot of things that you don't really see in video games that much, especially in use of gameplay and how it affects narrative.
It's not like a point-and-click adventure. It's not like a Telltale game where most of the answers are inherently obvious. It really, really immerses you in the world it's trying to create, and with that it gets you more attached to these characters.
And I think this is heavily sort of thanks to the art style, the visualizations of everything, obviously the writing to a degree, which was sort of critically panned, at least for the first two episodes at the very least.
For the dialogue, anyway.
But I think it's just a strange game where the advertising campaign managed me to just kind of say, yeah, I'm never going to play this game. And then when we downloaded it, we were like, hey, let's get the season pass. Let's talk about the art style. What about it did worked so well for you, especially throughout the first couple of episodes? What convinced you about this game?
Well, in episodic games, you can never have a huge amount of graphical assets, especially since these files were never more than 2 gigabytes each. They were always in the ballpark of a gigabyte. And you can't put in a great amount of graphical fidelity when you're working with such small file sizes, in addition to creating a several hour long installment of game. So I was just really impressed of how their artistic vision was able to trump the hard drive assets that they were budgeted to work with. Because it's a very stylish game. All the textures in this game were hand-painted.
I think what makes it interesting is the fact that as a game, the art style functions as a testament to how to cohesively create a long-running game with bridging narrative, which obviously already make the game technically longer, although it feels shorter than it really is. And yet managing to make do with the limited resources you have.
I was struggling with the word throughout, and it finally clicked with me today, is that it's very impressionistic. When you look at the print material on the walls, and I'm talking posters, pictures, it's never using in-game assets. It's always drawn, similar to how in a cartoon they would use a separate animation style to simulate cartoons, watching cartoons, if that makes sense.
Right. It's a fascinating visual look, and I think it's essentially what got a lot of people interested in the game in the first place.
It's incredibly charming, and it's so consistent the way it goes from all of the episodes.
I think it's fascinating to consider the fact that it is a game that's it's very beautiful, and I think despite everything, despite the maybe dead eyes look of the protagonists and some of the characters, you still get a lot of emotion out of the setting. Gameplay-wise, what is it you guys liked about Life is Strange, especially, at least in the very first couple of episodes?
So the whole mechanic, the gimmick behind the game is that you can rewind time for just a brief moment and like Nick Cage in that one movie.
Next.
Yeah.
What a go away.
And Next. You can really figure out what branches of results your actions have.
There were several moments that stood out to me in particular. The big one that a lot of people were talking about when that episode came out was at the end of episode two, where Kate has her suicide attempt, and you have to talk her down from the ledge. But before you even get up to the roof with her, you're in the quad with the rest of the student body, and you're watching her jump. And for me anyway, you know, my reaction was, you know, I want to save Kate. You know, Kate's a fun character. And I hit that rewind button while she's in midair. But if you hold down that rewind, she will not reach the roof, no matter how long you hold it. And it will not regenerate either. So Max does not even need to say that her power isn't working. It's for the player to realize through their own actions that the rewind will not save Kate. And that makes it even more powerful when you have to get up onto the roof and talk her down, that there are no retries. That was the first subversion of your expectations, because up until that point, it was a crux, and now they pull that out from under you. But also, another thing you could rely on was Max would retain important information in that it would be underlined when you went back to talk to people. Say if you found a password out or gleaned important information, the game would indicate to you that newly found information. With Kate, they do not give you any of those visual cues.
Right.
You have to, it's not Max's memory, it's the player's memory.
It's an interesting reward for the players who cared enough to explore what Don't Nod presented to them. Because at the end of the day, the game's levels are big. We just feel that they're small because, narratively speaking, there isn't a lot going on. Like, when our objective is get to the dorm room, we can go straight to the dorm room. But we shouldn't, because there's so much else to do.
You could spend an hour in the girls' dorm in episode one, easily. Yeah.
And because there's so much to explore, you can learn so much from each of the side characters that doesn't necessarily hold weight in that exact episode, not even. It pays off later when questions arise, like saving Kate's life, that can only be saved by the player who has made sure to do their research. It's almost like rewarding you for like an exam that you've had to study for. So I think a segment that really shines in Life is Strange, at least where the gameplay mechanics really show their virtues, is the segment in episode 4 with Franks.
With Nathan's
information about the drug deals. Now, I think what really shows here is all of the ways that the bridging narrative works, because if you compare Life is Strange to all of its genre peers, it might not be as polished visually or as exciting as some of the Quantic Dream games or Telltale games, but you know what? Here, the bridging narratives works better than in probably all
in
of the
any
others.
Of those. Easily, yeah.
It really doesn't feel quite as on rails because of the drastic circumstances things can have. And whilst not until dawn, you had the drastic circumstances, someone dies, it doesn't actually change anything in the actual narrative. So let's talk about what can happen with Frank here. Ed, you want to kick this off?
So going back to episode two, depending on whether you chose to pull the trigger on Frank or not in the junkyard. If you do choose to shoot him, you keep the gun, but you've made an enemy. If you chose not to, you know, fire at him, well, then he takes your gun, and then you don't have a gun in that scene, which comes into play later. And additionally, in
episode four,
you can also
get a gun
if you choose to beat Nathan while he's down. It matters who has guns and who doesn't in that scene, because the outcome, depending on who's armed and who isn't, is Frank can leave there being your friend with a bullet in his leg or shot dead.
In addition to whether or not his dog is also present.
The dog is an important factor as well. If Pompidou got hit by a car, he's not going to be, Frank's not going to sick him on you.
I think it's just a great segment overall. Gameplay-wise, it presents something that's both cinematic and something that's entirely unique to the medium of games. I think that's what makes it better than a lot of its genre peers, because whilst we all enjoyed playing, Heavy Rain, we certainly didn't get the vibe that this was anything other than a movie.
Yeah.
That's the end of the sentence. So moving on to episode 5. Let's just give a brief outline what happens in episode 4. So episode 4 is the big tonal shift of this series, and it was also the one that received some critical panning, to my surprise, because I guess
it was the tone shift.
It's kind of disappointing that that is what upset people, because in a way that is the game's strongest suit.
That's the point.
The fact that this game was released periodically, while I hate this about so many games being released periodically these days, I think it was a fantastic decision on Dontnod to do this episodically in this format, because by releasing these episodes 2 months apart every single time, you had no other choice but to think that all 5 of these episodes are going to be tonally identical. And when episode 4 throws that curveball at us and suddenly turns from Degrassi to, Go with the Dragon Tattoo.
But at the same time, it's not a jarring tonal shift. It doesn't, change so much that
there,
it warrants
there was
complaints.
Always, yeah.
I think what's great is that it does not in any way play out to the detriment of the greater narrative. And
yeah,
I think,
they planted the seeds early on.
And I think what's fantastic is I remember playing the first episode, and we probably played it 4 times, 3 times before episode 2 even came out. And we were all yelling at the screen going, this is just going to be Twin Peaks. This is just going to be some mystical bullshit. We're going to get something Native American going on. And there were so many misdirections in this game that when we realized by episode 4 that this is actually a serial killer game, I loved that. Mm-hmm. I thought that was the best possible move that a game developer could make. We know for a fact that plenty of gamers out there are 14-year-old girls who did buy this game.
Of course.
And I think they were extremely surprised when episode 4 came around. And I think that is what makes the game so freaking great for anyone who's outside of that demographic. Because all of a sudden, Dontnod said, no, this game doesn't need to be for just one group of people. It can be for everyone. And that's what's fantastic.
It has a very wide range of appeal.
Episode 4 brings us into a very, very tense opening for episode 5.
Oh, incredibly disturbing.
And, of course, we don't want to go too much into the details of every single thing that happens in episode 5.
So we could be talking forever.
We could go on that for hours. But what really, really works is the fact that we've got an episode that's almost extremely pessimistic.
Oh, it does not.
Episode 5?
Yeah. For its opening half, where you start to realize that your ability to rewind time can only help you so much. What's fascinating is the fact that we rewind again and again and again. We go to these extremely far-off places and then go into the future and then go back in time. And it's almost like I'm watching Click with Adam Sandler, only now I'm being told, regardless how much you try, someone you love is gonna die. Whether it's you, or whether it's Chloe, or whether it's... it doesn't matter. And I think that's great. That was a really great segment. And so
that's the lesson to be learned in all this. They really hit that hard later on in the episode, that's for sure.
The Real Artist segment. What did you guys like?
So, well, let's run it by ourselves again to give us a refresher. Max is able to look at a picture in her journal while in Jefferson's captivity. And she tells David of his doings, going back to episode 1, and everything's fine, supposedly. and while she's in San Francisco. And it's really a scene where I think the developers wanted to make fun of themselves a little bit, because you got the hipster chic thing going on with the art gallery. And one of my favorite parts of this episode 5, is when you focus on her picture and people interrupt you while she's focusing on it, and like, oh, you're Max Caulfield, and they want to interview her and stuff, but no, she needs to be focused on saving her friends back in Arcadia Bay.
And it's a fascinating, well what this segment really functions as is, it's the perfect life for Max, but the worst destiny for everybody else, because everyone is killed in the storm in that universe. And what really works here, in my opinion at least, is the fact that we have a segment that is slowly gearing us towards the meta territory that we later get into. And I think,
yes.
I think it's a segment where we're literally looking at photographs, and the entire game we've been taking photographs, and now we're being talked to about our photographs. And someone even makes one of the like small extra characters even makes the offhand comment of, I like how you subverted the imagery by putting it into your own picture. And it's weird because the game is doing that as well. Because the game is putting your own imagery into a frame in a gallery that you're now in. It's very weird, and it totally works, and I think it's a really, really fun moment. It's very endearing, and it's probably also like, it's probably the happiest moment you have in the entire episode, and
if not the entire game.
Yeah, it really is the short segment before the downhill slope.
Oh,
and let's talk downhill. About it. So, the fight, Jefferson versus David, and like, God, if this were a WWE match, it should happen. I mean, come on.
In that segment, it's really some split second reactions, but you have to understand how both of these characters behave. If you have Jefferson take a picture of you before David comes, he'll set the camera down in a place where David can grab it and hit him with it, to save himself from being clubbed by the tripod stand.
Okay, interesting. And the way I did it was, I had him just trip on the cable from the light fixture. Is that it?
I don't believe you trip him, but you distract him with the light fixture.
Oh, right. It tips. So I have it tip over, and he tries to, like, pick it up.
Additionally, when you ask him for water, you'll then have the trolley next to you, so that instead of David hitting him with the camera, you could hit Jefferson by pushing the trolley into him, leaving him open for David. And there's even methods that involve David not even getting knocked on the ground in the first place.
Right. So it's just a really cool segment where we're it doesn't really pay off to the greater narrative, especially because a lot of episode 5 doesn't really do that. It almost does it as a way of showing the fans, look at all the ways this gameplay mechanic can still work. And it makes me excited for anything Dotemu will do in the future if they keep up this franchise, which I really hope they do. So the storm segment, let's talk about that briefly before we move on. What did you guys like about it? I know very much what I liked about it, and the reason I liked this segment is because I played it like a friggin' idiot. And I'm not even, like, I can't even begin to explain how bad I was in the segment. I was so eager to see what happens in the game's plot that I forgot entirely about the fact that there was a friggin' tornado killing people. And I forgot to save every single character in that segment. I don't know. What do you think, Ed?
They're always stressing that you are Super Max and you're an everyday hero, but it always just feels like praise, because you're always just doing something that anybody would do, whether it's comforting a friend or exposing a bully. But in this segment, there are your friends, whether it be students or townsfolk, that are getting killed by flying debris or by explosions, You know, just all this crazy stuff, and you are
literally super maxing your way through this level.
Yes, you're helping people out of burning buildings. You're preventing like chain reactions from just killing off like vast swaths of the cast.
Right. Everyone except me. I played asshole, Max.
And that was very entertaining in its own, to be fair.
Yeah, I didn't even see the people get killed. I was that bad of a gamer in this segment.
But it makes more sense for the later part of the episode.
Yeah. So, the later part of the episode. Let's get to this. The ending. So, the ending is introduced through a crazy nightmare sequence. And, I mean, this is what fascinated me is... I was reading reviews to this final episode after I finished it and found out that people hate the nightmare segment.
And it's the most bizarre thing.
And it's so strange to me to hate the nightmare segment because it is the absolute pinnacle of the game's message. And it works so well in tandem with how the game concludes. Just because there's a stealth segment within the nightmare sequence that maybe isn't polished to, you know, a T. Who really... That's not fair to criticize this game for, because there's a lot of things that aren't polished to a T, and you still love it.
Yeah.
I think the nightmare segment works. I think what's important is that it functions on two very distinct black and white levels of all the memories you've made with Chloe and showing us the entire townsfolk of Arcadia Bay. And... literally pitting the two of them against each other, but very visually in a way so that we aren't able to notice what the game is implying
until
the end.
Until the end, and that's when we hit the rock in the hard place.
When you speak to Jefferson, you aren't able to say anything that you want to say. The game forces you to like flirt with the man who killed your friend or multiple friends,
right,
depending on how you've played it. And that's fascinating.
It messes with your perception of all of the character relationships that you've built up as a player.
We love the fact that like it's trippy and weird and all that, but I think it's a lot deeper than that because it's once again gearing us closer and closer towards its meta message. And it's interesting because we have this conversation with Mr. Jefferson, and Max yells to herself, "I'm not going to say any of these things." And it's great because suddenly we're realizing who's in control. Like, oh my god, who is it? Is it us? Is it Max? Is anyone in control? And that's where the game starts to ask the big, big question. And we've never really asked it to ourselves until episode 5. Who is in control? Max is objectively in control of everything up until episode 5, because she can literally rewind time and change the course of anyone's destiny. But when we hit the rock in the hard place in the last segment, we find out that we have to make the choice of either sacrificing the entirety of Arcadia Bay in order to keep Chloe alive, or going all the way back to the first episode and letting Chloe die in the very bathroom that we saved her in, which is mind-bogglingly brilliant, actually, from a writing perspective, especially for a game that I didn't anticipate to have an ending that would impress me.
It's very, like you said, very meta, almost postmodern in a sense, and it's not at all what I expected the ending for this game to be. I was prepared for tone shift. I was prepared for like some revelation about your role and the reason you have these powers and why you. But I wasn't expecting the game, in a very self-aware way, highlight its own themes that the player is experiencing through Max.
It's almost like the game knows everything that most people hate about it, and it laughs at the people who think that it doesn't know that.
Well, yeah, it functions in the same way maybe the first Bioshock's thing was of...
Would you kindly, yeah.
Yeah, and having a player go from point A to point B on instruction.
And I think what's fascinating is the fact that I went into this game thinking this is going to be a feel-good game from start to finish almost, with like a fun little murder mystery attached to it for, you know, like the teen audience. But when we get to episode 5, I noticed a tone shift and I was like, well, where's this going to go? But my expectancy was, oh, well, Mr. Jefferson's going to get caught and Max and Chloe are going to live happily ever after, and it's going to close on like a super sappy montage.
You go ape with Warren
to the drive-thru.
Tea with Kate.
Yeah, exactly. You hang out with Kate.
The whole 9 yards.
Yeah, exactly. It would have to close on like the backyard barbecue with and like
Joyce and David.
Yeah, Joyce and David's flipping burgers in the back, and Chloe and Max are on the swing set together, and they've like,
and heck, Victoria's with them too.
Yeah, it's just
but
like,
no, but not at all.
I really wanted to get that sappy ending because I thought I deserved it, and all of it. Oh, and yeah, it's actually like, don't not is like, you don't deserve shit.
No, we're gonna
you don't deserve a happy ending. And what's great is that we thought that the big plot reveal is Max and Rachel Amber are literally the same individual from a
different universe.
And they've somehow molded together in some weird Bioshock Infinite kind of way. And wouldn't have surprised me in the slightest, especially because of the fact that we never really see Rachel's face when you discover her body. And it could have been like episode 5 closes with you guys going back to Rachel's body and taking the bag off of her.
It's like Max.
And it's Max inside. And it's like, oh my god, Booker DeWitt. And, you know, like, it didn't do that. And I loved that for it. But it's really the postmodern qualities that make this final episode work. And before we keep throwing that word around and having you guys think that we just are claiming this game's postmodern without justifying it, let us explain why.
Yeah, absolutely. This game, prior to the release of episode 1, it was harshly criticized by a lot of members on the internet community because you get a lot of these quotes saying, it's Gone Home meets Walking Dead. It's a playable indie movie, like Juno and Twin Peaks all rolled into one. And it just made it, like, really... And episode 1 didn't really do anything to make you think otherwise. It was, like, a very kitschy, very Tumblr core, like, feel-good ode to nostalgia. And it's weird because it's nostalgia for the present. I don't care if it's set in 2013. It was that, like, kind of, like, end of summer, going into fall...
it's all about like autumn leaves, Polaroid look. Yeah, it's like it's hipster literally aesthetic. it's literally like your Instagram account decided to make a movie.
Yeah. Right.
And it's fascinating that a developer would release a game, market it that way, knowing that the demographic that would play it is probably, you know,
the younger crowd, teens that would buy into that.
Yeah, and then the game goes, you know, Neon Genesis Evangelion on us in its closing chapter.
It's a complete refutation at the end of nostalgia. You're forced into a choice at the end of the game between sacrificing Chloe and setting the timeline straight, or sacrificing Arcadia Bay, letting the storm go by so that you can keep your friend. Now, if you sacrifice Arcadia Bay, first of all, you're an awful person because you just let everybody die. But second of all, you are clinging to your past in the form of your childhood friend Chloe. You do not let her go. That's the timeline where Max does not learn like her lesson that she can't hold on to the past forever, and she indulges in her nostalgia.
And it's almost like the game punishes you for making that decision because it gives you a rather vapid ending. It gives you a short closing sequence. And whilst most viewers would think, oh, well, you know, they got lazy with this finale, I like that that finale doesn't satisfy the gamer because it shouldn't.
It's very much, it's not like an A or B choice, it's a right or wrong choice.
It's kind of like, it reminds me of how The Last of Us actually ends with an ending that gives you absolutely no control. And I love the fact that the game gives you no control in that last segment, because it reminds you at the end of the day, you might be playing a game, but the best stories are the stories that you aren't in charge of, because these characters are still characters.
You let them act according to...
You let them act according to what makes them tick as characters. And I think it's a great sign of Life is Strange's strength that it has a real ending. And although it makes you think that it has two real endings, I like to think it really only has...
Because if you do sacrifice Chloe, you truly are letting go of your past at this point. You're abandoning nostalgia. In return, you get to keep all of these friends you've made over the course of the game. You see them all show up at the funeral. It's really touching. Kind of a tearjerker scene.
Yeah, and you are literally putting your memories 6 foot under. So it's a burying of everything you had clung onto for these five episodes. And I think what I really loved, at least in this segment, was I suddenly had that epiphany, and it came to me slowly, but I realized it when I was playing. I was like, I spent this entire game trying to find out why Max has this power. Why is Max able to rewind time? Why can she do this? What is the reason for all of this? And what does the storm have to do with her power? Because we realize, like, something with these natural occurrences, there was a tie-in with her actual ability to foresee the future and to rewind. But what we never thought about was, what if the moment Chloe died is the moment she got the power? What if the moment Chloe died is the moment the natural occurrences started happening? And it's a brilliant technique. After we discovered the ability to go back in time by looking at photographs, I started paying attention to every single photograph we took in the game. So I thought, oh, look, we just took a photo with Warren before the party. That's going to help us in episode 5. Yes. But I never, once I discovered that, went back to think, oh, we took a photo of the butterfly just before Chloe got shot. I never made that connection. And I think it's brilliant that it has that there, but because you're taking photos so consistently in the game, you write it off as just like another...
It's a side activity.
Just another side activity.
Yes.
And that's actually really smart, both a narrative technique and a gameplay technique.
And I like that the rewind is not explained. You think that it's like part of some great purpose to like save the world, and it's not. Because it's obviously not...
It's actually the opposite.
It's not, in fact. Yeah. It's not there to save Chloe, because Chloe is fated to die. Without, you know, unless you pay, like, severe consequences in the death of everyone else you know.
Well, right. Yeah, it's the lesson learned, because it begins and ends at her death.
Right. And it's not to bring justice for Rachel Amber, because if you let Chloe die, Nathan will turn Jefferson in for you. It's really just there so that Max can learn that lesson about letting go.
In addition, some little postmodern moments that totally worked were picking up the bottles during the nightmare sequence, where Max very evidently... is upset about the fetch quest. Now, this could be written off as, you know, fan service, but I like to look at it from the perspective of a game very self-awarely telling itself, well, you know, are we a video game, or what are we? What are we really? Because that's the segment of the game where
reality breaks down
and we begin to question what it is we're even playing and who's in control.
In fact, the whole concept of time mechanic just being a... way of Max learning to let go of the past really makes you question, well, did anything in that game really happen?
Right.
Because in her timeline, it didn't.
It could have never occurred.
This could have just been a fever dream of Max.
This could have been Max's coping mechanism for letting Chloe die and thinking, why did I let Chloe die? If only I had the power to rewind time.
Yes.
And it could have just worked like that.
And to have a purpose in and of itself rather than, you know, just say, hey, this was a thing.
So that's why when I hear the complaint that the ending is not coherent, I beg to differ. In fact, I'm willing to say this is one of the strongest endings in gaming in countless years. I mean, people are still raving about the Phantom Pain. The Phantom Pain's ending was not as good as this.
It's very clear who played the game and who didn't when you read reviews.
So, it's let's see an episode score breakdown. What do you think? What is your favorite episode?
MVPs? Alec, do you want to take this?
So my favorite episode is episode 4, winning just slightly of episode 5, because episode 5 is magnificent. But episode 4 really, with that tonal shift, really changed the player's perception of most all of the characters and how they really function with or without Max. Right. Alternate Chloe is completely different from her counterpart, and she's way more endearing in the reality with her dad. And that segment too was like it was gut wrenching.
It's a cool episode.
Yes.
It's probably the coolest episode. Yes. For me, episode 5 is the clearest winner. I think it simply wins as a feat of storytelling, and to me, that's what Life is Strange is all about. I think the thing that makes Life is Strange a game unlike anything else released this year is the fact that it is a story game that feels like it has a reason to be a video game as opposed to just a movie. It makes you rethink the way you think of characters. The fact that Victoria can die in episode 5 is brilliant because you hate Victoria. And I think a lot of people might write off episode 5 as having a similar flaw that episode 3 had, where you have the feeling that a lot of your choices are being annulled. But I don't think your choices are being annulled maliciously here. I think they're being annulled for a very, very good reason.
It ties into the final theme.
Into the final theme. And because the fact that the game has an overriding message, a theme of such serious weight, is an incredible feat for a video game.
It's a good... it's not a bad point that people bring up, that the ending is a binary choice. It is, and it invalidates everything you've done before in the sense that it doesn't matter if you save Kate or not, or Victoria, or kill Frank or not, because if you sacrifice Chloe, everyone ends up living.
And yet, no one brings that complaint up when they play Until Dawn, but at the end of the day, Until Dawn is nothing other than how many of your characters live or die.
They're a score sheet.
Honestly, I think it's a game that children should play. Like, it's a good game. Like, it has good moral intentions. So, Ed, your favorite episode.
My favorite episode. Well, you know, 5 was a strong contender, especially that ending that just floored me. I can't quite give it to 5, though, because the first half of the episode is a lot of static dialogue, and that's what brings it down a peg, you know, for me. Still phenomenal. I just have to say, in terms of how I reacted after playing it, episode 2 really impressed me. I mentioned the Kate scene. That was just the most ingenious part from a craftsmanship perspective and how the Kate scene functioned.
Right.
It was a very themed episode. It was standalone in a sense because it revolved... you kind of take a hiatus from investigating Rachel to saving Kate. It was a nice detour that still ties into the overall plot with Jefferson and Nathan. It proved that this was a game to seriously consider. After episode 1, I was just like ironically liking this game almost, but episode 2 sold me on Life is Strange. It proved that it could have some dark, very dark themes. It proved that it was well crafted and that the choice system, even in the principal's office, assigning blame, can lead to Jefferson suspended, Nathan suspended, David suspended, or even Max suspended, depending on how she approached the Nathan situation and the Kate situation in the previous 2 episodes.
It's a really fun segment, and I think overall we're in full agreement that this is a highly recommendable game. I wish people who are new to this game can experience from the perspective of waiting in 2-month intervals between episodes, because I feel like doing repeated playthroughs in between your 2 months actually almost increases the quality of the experience.
Oh, definitely.
It's kind of
I comprehended the game a lot better.
It's like playing. It's like watching your favorite TV show and enjoying it multiple times over as you anticipate the hype for the next week's release. And that's really what makes this game so special. But yeah, this concludes our very in-depth discussion on the WWE SmackDown versus Raw fight between Jefferson and Davis. But yeah, episode 5, Life is Strange, fantastic game. Thank you for tuning in to Crossfader Magazine's first podcast ever. Hopefully we'll have a couple more on this running. We will be switching off between video games, television, film, and all sorts of other special content. Hope to see you more in the future. And you can find us on XFDR Mag to read film, television, music, video game reviews, as well as special features on all sorts of cultivated culture. So, Crossfader, cultivated culture. Hope to see you next time.